Welcome to the School of Economic Science annual lecture. On behalf of the Economic and Law faculty, welcome to all the students of the School of Economic Science here, and also a particular welcome to any guests and visitors. The school is a centre of spiritual and practical knowledge and inquiry, and particularly we offer classes in practical philosophy and economics with justice. We see that a combination of a philosophy that's practical in your daily life and an economic system that's based on justice is the foundation of a healthy society. The speaker this evening is Mr. Ian Mason. Ian is the principal of the school and the head of the law and economics faculty. He does those for love, with love as well, and a lot of devotion. By day he's a barrister and has a particular interest in the developing subject of earth jurisprudence. Economics with justice is at heart a positive outlook. Economics with justice is not a dismal science, it is full of hope. And the title of this evening's lecture is in that vein, World Without Want. And the stated aim is that Mr. Mason will refer to natural law to explore the possibilities of an economic system which both cares for and protects the earth whilst providing widespread prosperity and stability for the human inhabitants. So, Mr. Mason.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you, Dr. Bowman, for the welcome, both to myself and to all of you who've taken the trouble to come this evening. It's very delightful to see you all here. I had a few moments waiting before coming in just now, and I came across this leaflet, which is on the table over there, from somebody called New Literacy. It's headed Food, Energy, Education. And on the back of it, it carries a quote from someone I've never heard of called Buckminster Fuller. It says, "You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete." And I draw it to your attention because in a way that is precisely what I want to try to do this evening. I want to put forward, if I can, the possibility of rebuilding our understanding of economics and, as a result, the economics that flows from our understanding of economics. Because unless something of that order happens, we are already well on our way to building a flawed economic system, or rebuilding a flawed economic system in the image of the one recently collapsed and has caused significant difficulties throughout the entire world economy. The title of the lecture is World Without Want. And those of you who are particularly observant and have good memories will recollect that that's a phrase that actually comes from the way we advertise our economics course, which is described as economics with justice. And there's a little strap line at the bottom. It says, "Economics with justice for a world without want." And justice has always been something which is at the heart of the school's approach to economics. And the sense of justice does involve everybody. Indeed, I will argue that it goes a little bit beyond everybody to include everything. But for the moment, it's perhaps sufficient to consider justice as justice for everybody, because frankly, if it isn't justice for everybody, it isn't justice at all. Now, the school was founded in 1937 and has been engaged in the study of economics consistently ever since. And during that time, it has consistently called for a new understanding of economics. And I suppose the objectives of that new understanding, I've listed about five here: a fairer distribution of wealth, less harm to the planet, free but fair trade, a revised relationship with land and the environment, and a renewed sense of human dignity, idealism, and potential. And it's suggested, at least, that all of those could be possibilities offered by our economic systems. And the school has consistently called for those really throughout its teaching of economics for the last 70-odd years. In 2003, a group of students from the school in the United Kingdom and overseas gathered together at Waterbury Estate in Oxfordshire and, in the course of a week of deliberations, composed what we called the Waterbury Declaration. And we boldly declared at that time, "People prosper where justice and equity are honoured." Today, a fifth of the world's population lacks the means to feed itself. That was today in 2003. This injustice and inequity will be resolved when the recognition of our common humanity becomes the foundation of our conduct. The declaration drew attention to the fact that 820 million people were suffering malnutrition or starvation, even though there were food surpluses in various parts of the world. It was noted that people were going without food while food was being sent abroad from the countries they lived in. It was noted that countries were importing food while their own producers fell into poverty. It was observed that poor government was creating conflict or corruption in all sorts of places. It could be seen that new technologies were upsetting relationships between communities and the natural world. And we noted that the opening of developing markets to international trade was securing neither prosperity nor social harmony for those dwelling in them. And we did our best to prescribe some possible remedies for those ills, some of which have been taken up. 2003, of course, was a time when the world was living very much in the shadow of the major incident at the Twin Towers in New York. The Millennium Development Goals were much in mind, and there was a certain amount of hope abroad about the new millennium, or at least the new century, that had begun only 2 or 3 years before. We still had another 3 or 4 years of economic boom ahead of us. At that time, the government in the United Kingdom was insisting that we had put an end to boom and bust. The school, I'm happy to say, was never, ever taken in by that particular remark and has consistently taught that our economic arrangements have boom and bust built into them. That will continue until those arrangements change. Well, 2007 did see an economic collapse, and one that raised serious questions about the viability of economic practices at all levels. Only a few weeks ago we heard that there are now over 1 billion people malnourished or actually starving in the globe as we sit here now. Nevertheless, what we are seeing is a desperate rush to restore what was lost with as little amendment as possible. Enough to pacify those who think that some people are making too much money out of the financial system. I think, however, it's fair to say that there is quite a lot of serious attention being given to some of what underlies our economic arrangements, and I hope I'm not being unduly optimistic in saying so. Certainly it's the case that the opportunity is and always will be available to put an end to the injustices and inequities of our economic systems if we have the courage and vision to avail it. What really matters now is to open up the possibilities that a new economics based on principles of justice and equity can offer and see how they can be realised. And they won't be realised without concerted effort and considerable determination. But if we can summon the courage and vision to open up the possibilities in our own minds, then new understandings can flow into our social and economic arrangements to the benefit of the entire world. I may add It's impossible in this day and age really to consider economics without considering the entire world, because we have successfully globalized the economy, and like it or not, economic activity in one place has repercussions almost everywhere else. And so it's important for economists to have an eye to the entire world. And I would add to that the phrase the entire living world, because it's now clear, and it has, I think, been growing in our consciousness for a decade or two now, that we as a human race are only one component of a very much larger living system. And in the same way that our economics in one place affects what happens to people in other places, so our economics everywhere affects that larger living world of which we are a part. Just as breathing more quickly affects the whole metabolism of the human body. I find that realizing this, coming home to this fact that we are part of a much larger living system, brings an immediate sense of humility and opens the possibility of a new direction to human thought. I think we have to come to terms with the fact that we can no longer consider ourselves to be the masters of the universe. It is not quite accurate to say any longer that man is the measure of all things. And we have to be able to direct our economic affairs with wider considerations. We cannot do so without taking account of the larger whole of which we are part. It is true, I think, to say that we are a highly developed and specialized part of that much greater whole. We have, for example, the capacity to understand that we are part of a much greater whole, and that by itself is an indication of the role that we have. But the task before us, the task that faces humanity, is to understand this part and how it is to be played, given the technological forces the human race has unleashed over the last century or so. Our sense of a common humanity is of the greatest importance in this, but our sense of a greater wholeness even more so. I mean, consider for a moment the impact that the human race has had. We've learned to clear the forests. Many places have lost more than half, some up to 80 or 90% of their forest cover. We cultivate the savannas and make all sorts of things grow there that didn't grow there before. We know how to stop and divert rivers and river systems. We can mine the depths of the earth, engineer soils. We harvest the lakes and the oceans until there's hardly anything else left living there. And for a long time, we thought we could do so with impunity. Well, the argument is now that the time has come to forge a new and mutually enhancing relationship, particularly including our economic relationship with the wonderful life of the planet that we live on. And to do so, we need to rediscover our capacity to care for, or at least about, each other. And this is why concepts of justice and equity actually matter, and why we say people prosper when they are honoured. Justice and equity express qualities of our sense of care, our love of our fellows, and for nature, and our unity with them. And in the school, certainly, we do our utmost to keep alive that sense of our common humanity. Because as one looks around the world, it is quite easy to notice that man's inhumanity to man often overwhelms our sense of common humanity. But nevertheless, it does seem that people everywhere do have a sense of what it is to be human, and do have a sense of communion with their fellows. And in an age which could be characterized by a certain cynicism, it seems important to keep a certain idealism alive and to highlight it whenever possible and to live by it whenever possible. In this context, we have to begin to see that economics is not merely a process of extraction and distribution, which is how it is often seen. It's really a process of transformation, which is itself a celebration of life and creativity. and it's worth considering what is meant by that. The first thing is that there's nothing that we eat or use that is not derived from the planet itself. We don't actually make anything. All we do is transform the things that are available to us and adapt them for our use. And that's a creative process, one in which human creativity is most valuable and able to be realized. But it's a process which has a beginning and an end in the natural materials available in the earth itself. And it's heartening to see in many parts of the world growing understanding and appreciation of the importance of this, just in the attention that is now being given to the way that we dispose of waste and dispose of things for which we no longer have a use, even to the extent of designing things so that they can be recycled, or making sure that we design them so that they can naturally return to their original elements quickly and efficiently and without pollution. Inevitably, there's a long way to go in achieving completion in that process. But the thinking is becoming normal, and that is to be applauded, because it is part of the adaptation of which I'm speaking. And without it, we can only expect that we will go on causing more and more damage to our planet and its ecosystems until it's a matter of threat even to our own capacity to survive. It's important, therefore, to adapt industry and agriculture to reflect this. And this can be done, and I'll say a bit more about that in a minute. Here in the UK and in many other parts of the developed world, we see a growth in enthusiasm for organic farming. I know it's falling back in the face of the recession, but nevertheless, the idea and enthusiasm is there. There's a growing grow-your-own movement, a growing sense, I think, here and certainly in the United States, that it really becomes a people to grow their own food. There are localization initiatives, like Transition Towns in the UK, which look to developing communities which are dependent locally rather than internationally, or at least locally before internationally. Even in the face of the ever-enlarging business systems, there's support for local businesses, local crafts, and so on. And one senses that in many places, there's a great enthusiasm for developing business operations, economic operations, on a scale that people can really relate to. All this reminds me a bit of the great Dr. E.F. Schumacher, who you may remember or may have heard, wrote the book Small is Beautiful, which was published, I think, in 1973 or 1974. In it, he included a chapter on Buddhist economics. And I refer to it because his view was that Buddhist economics would be completely different from the economics of production and consumption, because Buddhists don't regard consumption as a satisfactory end in itself. The Buddhist point of view, he wrote, takes the function of work to be at least threefold: to give a man a chance to utilize and develop his faculties, to enable him to overcome his ego-centeredness by joining with other people in a common task, and to bring forth the goods and services needed for a becoming existence. And I dwell on that phrase for a moment, a becoming existence, because it indicates, as it were, a way of thinking about how we live. And a question for us all, perhaps, is our existence becoming, in the sense of gracious and appropriate? As Schumacher put it, the Buddhist sees the essence of civilization not in a multiplication of wants, but in the purification of human character. Character, at the same time, is formed primarily by a man's work. And work properly conducted in conditions of human dignity and freedom blesses those who do it and also their products. He describes Buddhist economics as the systematic study of how to attain given ends with the minimum means, adding, since consumption is merely a means to human well-being, the aim should be to obtain the maximum of well-being with the minimum of consumption. And you may think that that aim is rather different from the aim of a fairly standard approach to economics, which in fact is to maximise consumption, in the hope that by doing so we can also maximise well-being. The school would add to this the importance of access to the naturally occurring materials necessary for all forms of agriculture and industry. Economic life begins and ends in the natural environment, represented by the land surface of the earth. It's the relationship with the land, more than anything else, that determines the effects and successes of economic arrangements at all levels, from the most simple food gathering and cultivation to the most complex financial sophistications. Here in the UK, we live at the sophisticated end of the spectrum, where the underlying importance of land is not always quite so obvious. Agriculture accounts for less than 0.9% of our economy. Although interestingly, agricultural land accounts for more than 76% of total land use. That's a statistic I got from DEFRA, dated 2008. Services ranging from wholesale and retail through financial services to education and health account for 76.2% of our economy, and industry and manufacturing for 22.8%. Nevertheless, I'm going to say quite a bit this evening about the food economy, and the reason for that is that it's easy to forget in places like the UK that food production accounts for the livelihoods of more than half of the world's total population. In addition, no economy can succeed which cannot feed its population. That, in the end, is what defeated the Soviet experiment in the 1980s. And without due care, it could just as easily defeat the experiment in global capitalism. However, the UK food industry as a whole accounts for 7% of national output and no less than 3.7 million jobs. According to DEFRA, food is Britain's largest manufacturing sector. I may pause at that point to say that it's worth considering what we're manufacturing, if food is part of the manufacturing sector at all. And it says quite a lot about our food production processes that it's included in the manufacturing sector at all. But that said, Britain produces 60% of its own food, although that proportion is falling. That compares with only 30% in the 1930s. The proportion shot up, of course, in the 1940s, when we had to start producing food because we couldn't get it any other way. And the last time that food production in the United Kingdom was at the level that it is now was in the 1870s. And nevertheless, it is now declining, to an extent that the government commissioned a Cabinet Office report, which resulted in a new food strategy from DEFRA for the next 20 years. The Cabinet Office report says that consolidation of manufacturing sites, distribution centres, higher truckload factors, faster order-to-delivery times, and ever lower stock levels make for an ever leaner food supply. What that means is that our actual food supply on the shelves in the shops where we need it is becoming more and more critical. I believe the system works on the basis that most shops have about 3 days' stock available to them, and the idea is to clear the shelves and replace the stock on a rolling basis every 3 days. And it's all based on what is called just-in-time delivery, so that there are not large stockpiles at the back of our supermarkets waiting to go on the shelves. This involves a highly sophisticated transport system, which, if disrupted, means that the shelves are likely to be empty. We got a hint of the possibilities last year when the oil prices shot up and transport became very expensive and in some cases difficult. But we overcame that and oil prices thankfully came back down again, but I noticed that they are climbing once more. And the predictions are that they are more likely to continue to climb than they are to fall back again in the years to come. The government rightly sees the situation as less than satisfactory. Not only are we dependent on overseas production for the remaining 40% of our food production, we're also increasingly dependent on overseas production for the oil, coal, and biofuels that make it possible for so small a proportion of our population to produce such a high proportion of our food. Food security and resilience to external shocks have become high priorities for government for good reason. In fact, I'm tempted to think that we will hear a lot more of this word resilience in years to come. It's beginning to take over from sustainability as the buzzword in economic affairs. And it really means the ability to withstand external shocks. The first of the reasons for concern, though, and the first of the shocks that is likely to have a serious impact, is in fact drought. Whether that's the result of climate change or whether it's the result of simply changing weather patterns remains to be seen. But in 2009, countries that account for no less than two-thirds of the world's food production experienced severe drought conditions. Here in Europe, we escaped that. But in Africa, in China, in Australia, in Brazil and Argentina, and in the US, all major food-producing countries, drought in 2009 was a very serious problem. It affects yields. It also affects planting for the coming year, and planting for 2010 is thought to be about 25% down on last year. And that also, of course, affects yields. The era of cheap food is going to be affected by that, and we're already seeing the price of food commodities rising. But there's more to it than all that, because nearly all these places are also experiencing severe soil depletion as a result of intensive farming practices. Shortage of water and poor soil is not a combination that makes it easy to feed an inexorably rising world population. Last week I attended a meeting which was addressed by Dr. Vandana Shiva, who is an Indian scientist who has spent her life campaigning on behalf of smallholder farmers in northern India. Part of her work has been to found an organisation called Navdanya, who set out to collect and catalogue and keep seeds. Seeds, because seed, of course, is the very essence of farming. And smallholder farmers characteristically collect and use the seeds that they grow themselves. The modern tendency, of course, is for seed to be big business, very big business. And Dr. Shiva has had a number of interesting interactions with some of the larger international corporations who have attempted to patent seed varieties by producing those very varieties herself and saying, how can you patent these? We've already got them. You have done nothing to them. And she's been quite successful in that. You may remember a few years ago there was an attempt to patent basmati rice, which has been growing for something like 1,000 years in India. Her assessment was simply this. Industrial agriculture is threatening the food security of our planet. That was her starting place. While more than 1 billion people suffer starvation or severe malnutrition, a small number of international corporations are tightening their grip on the world's food supplies. And she describes them as advancing on three fronts. First, they are steadily tightening their grip on seed supplies, especially through the introduction of patented GM varieties. This has significant effects on particularly smallholders, because if they want to grow those varieties, which are the varieties that are required by the international markets, they have to buy the seeds. To buy the seeds, they very often have to borrow. They then have to buy the necessary fertilizers and so on to grow the seeds. And they have to borrow money for that. And it's a fact that throughout agricultural communities the world over, debt has become an extremely serious problem. Dr. Shiva is particularly incensed by the fact that in northern India, where she does most of her work, there have been no less than 150,000 suicides of farmers because they couldn't cope with debts. That's the first way in which international corporations are tightening their grip on seed supplies. Secondly, they are steadily driving smallholders who specialise in varied food production from their land so that they can create industrial-scale farming units. Small holdings are disappearing. And again, it's a phenomenon which happens in every developing economy. As soon as economic activity picks up, interest in land picks up with it, and the tendency to consolidate land holdings immediately begins. And there are tales of that from, again, every part of the world where there are developing economies. So the great land grab is the second approach of the international corporations. Thirdly, control of the entire retail chain is concentrating in fewer and fewer hands, forcing suppliers to seek ever cheaper means of production, mostly through mechanisation and through forcing small-scale farmers out of the market. Today, the world's highest traded crops, such as corn, soya, rice and cotton, are all treated as commodities. And the biggest trade in all of them is in genetically modified varieties. Industrial-scale farming certainly produces more of these commodities, but it's well established that it produces less actual food per acre, and it also leaves food producers hungry. Dr. Shiva points out that because the commodity markets do not distinguish between food for people, food for cattle, food for fuel, and food for industry, we do not notice that the increasing hunger of machines actually makes greater demands on modern food production than the hunger of human beings. In India, despite annual GDP growth rates in the region of 9%, every fourth Indian is seriously hungry. Even in this era of cheap food, sufficient nourishing food is beyond the purchasing power of 25% of the population. And yet land and resources are being diverted from food production to commodity production. According to Dr. Shiva and many others, the intelligent response to all this is ecological agriculture, which she at least sees as the only road to freedom. Small farms rooted in biodiversity can produce up to 10 times as much food per acre, with the added bonus of being the most efficient way of converting atmospheric carbon dioxide into healthy humus for fertile soils. And I'll have a bit more to say about some of the benefits of a more ecological approach to agriculture in a few minutes. But the second speaker following Dr. Shiva last week was Patrick Holden, who is chairman of the UK's Soil Association. And they, as you know, are responsible for organic certification in the United Kingdom, and they're a campaigning organisation. He reported the same tendency to fewer and fewer producers, processors, packers and distributors in the UK food industry. He reports, for example, that 80% of carrots, including organic carrots, in the UK come from just 10 carrot growers. All our supermarket milk comes from only 5 major processes, and it's soon likely to be 4. He also reports that those who thought that we'd succeeded in keeping GM foods out of the UK are deluding themselves. More than 1 million tonnes of GM soya and maize is fed to UK pigs, chickens and dairy cows annually, with no labelling requirement on the final product. So it's an import industry that's likely to continue. The third speaker was Liz Hoskin of the Gaia Foundation, a friend of mine for some years. She, agreeing with both Vandana Shiva and Patrick Holden, views all this as evidence of what Gandhi would have described as a deeply violent society, which institutionalises violence to the soil and to seeds and to animals and to farmers and to consumers and to ourselves by the food that we eat produced by these methods. And Gandhi's response, she says, would be to fight back non-violently, by not participating in violent systems and by building alternatives. And that means choosing and taking the trouble to eat less violently produced food and supporting local growers and retailers by choosing food produced locally and with integrity. She points out that every penny of our household budget is a vote for the system that produces what we buy. This, of course, means rediscovering how to nurture the soil so that the soil nurtures us. It means knowing the story of the food that we eat and reclaiming food sovereignty and security by growing as much of our own food as possible. That's not to say that we all have to go away and be smallholders, incidentally, but that we need to, as it were, rebalance our economy so that the economy is directed more locally than internationally, at least when it comes to the production of food. Now, of course, these prescriptions are excellent for those who can afford them. But there is another all-important factor. One has to ask, what is behind this drive for cheaper and cheaper food? And the economic reality behind it is that billions of people the world over can't actually afford to pay for food that has been produced locally with care and integrity. The School of Economic Science, for example, has an estate in Oxfordshire which has a horticultural centre. For quite a long time, that horticultural centre grew food for the local market in Oxford. But eventually it became uneconomic to do so, because the food could not command prices sufficient to pay the cost of paying the people who grew it and took it to the market and sold it. And that's a reality the world over. Now, the reasons for this lie in the prevailing economics, which forces people into a working environment where they must compete with their fellows for jobs by accepting wages that have already been competed to a minimum, or by selling at prices that have already been competed to a minimum. And you can notice this in the UK. Household budgets have two major components. One is food and the other is housing. And it is a fact that people will spend as much of their budget as possible on getting housing which is as adequate to their wants as they can. And if they can spend less on food, they welcome it, because it means that they can have better accommodation, provided they can maintain their income levels. But the pressure of house prices, including rents and mortgages, is one of the features which brings about this drive for cheaper food. And the drive for cheaper food brings about the drive for much more mechanized and cheaper forms of agriculture. Now, the effect of this competition spreads across the globe. British and a lot of European agriculture is no longer actually economic, because agricultural labour is so much cheaper in other parts of the world. And so is agricultural land, because we've established in Western Europe certain standards of living which we extend to the whole population and which people expect. Those standards of living, of course, are gradually spreading around the globe with other effects as well. But the result is that farm gate food prices will not provide what's become an acceptable income to the inhabitants of Britain, whilst also paying for the land to grow it on. Elsewhere, they're not sufficient to support a small farmer and his family, while at the same time providing sufficient revenue to pay for seed, fertiliser and machinery. And all this, of course, plays into the hands of industrial-scale farming enterprises. They have the capacity to provide the capital inputs which dispense with the need for expensive human eyes, hands and energy by replacing them with machines. And this is what capital inputs have become. Not the provision of tools and equipment that make human work more effective and productive, but the replacement of human work, fueled by nourishing food, by immense machines fueled by oil, and now increasingly by organically produced fuels whose production is displacing human food production and having devastating effects on the environment. And all that comes from the underlying situation of competitive pressure on wages. This, of course, raises serious questions which need to be addressed by economists. Firstly, why has the human relationship with land and the capacity to grow food become so distorted that farmers can no longer grow the food that they and their neighbours need? This is quite a serious question and an extraordinary phenomenon. Secondly, who is benefiting from this situation and to what purpose? And thirdly, how can economics, and through economics, governments and policymakers, address the position? Now, evidently, these questions don't readily admit of short and easy answers. But the beginnings of answers are not too difficult to see. In most westernised economies, the relationship with the land has been distorted by believing that land can be privately owned without obligation and can be bought and sold with impunity. It can, in effect, be turned into a commodity. The older understanding that the land does not belong to anybody and that we humans belong to the land has been lost to modern economics. And the real beneficiaries of this situation, of course, are those who can establish ownership and control of productive land, whose purpose is to benefit themselves and their shareholders, because many of them, of course, do have shareholders, but not to benefit those who must live and work on the land if they can. This position could be addressed by governments and policymakers by the establishment and enforcement of simple obligations on those who claim exclusive ownership or occupation of land. Such obligations are routinely applied to tenants by landlords. There's no reason why they should not equally be applied by governments, local or national, to landlords. And indeed, from time to time, attempts are made to do so, although they're often resisted quite strongly by those who have most to lose. Now, after all this, you could be forgiven for asking, first of all, whether economics ever has any good news, and secondly, whether there's anything remotely resembling practicality in all that I've been saying. And well, here I'm most grateful to this evening's chairman, Dr. Bowman, for drawing attention to the 2007 Human Development Report from Thailand. It appears from that report that we here in Britain are not alone in having an apparently eccentric royal personality with an interest in alternatives. Because King Bhumibol of Thailand appears to share many of the interests of the Prince of Wales, with the added advantage of coming to the throne at the age of 18 in 1946, and of having had a lifetime, despite all sorts of vicissitudes in the governments of Thailand, a lifetime to influence those governments through all of them and being effective in doing so, not least by being able to reach directly to the people themselves and motivate them. Prince Bhumibol's approach is what he calls sufficiency economics. And the word sufficiency is the key. And it's important immediately to note that sufficiency does not mean self-sufficiency. It means sufficiency in the sense of sufficient, having enough, but not too much. And the Human Development Report of 2007 describes sufficiency economics and its application in Thailand. The report tells us that the period since 1946 was an active development era in Thailand. And from the 70s to the 90s, Thailand was becoming a fifth Asian tiger economy. It was doing very well. In Thailand, more than 50% of the population were smallholder farmers, and they were in danger of being ignored or even becoming victims of this successful development. And the king's idea was to develop technologies, infrastructure, and production systems which were appropriate for small-scale farmers. He could, in fact, have been a model for Dr. Schumacher's Buddhist economics. From early in his reign, he launched and supported projects to support the economy around small-scale farmers, which accounted for the largest proportion of his population. And this developed into what became known as sufficiency economics. The report describes sufficiency economics as an approach to life and conduct which is applicable at every level through the family and community to the management and development of the nation. It promotes a middle path, especially in a developing economy, to keep up with the world in the era of globalization. Sufficiency has three key principles. The first is moderation, the second, wisdom or insight, and the third, the need for built-in resilience against the risks which arise from internal and external change. Those applying these principles are expected to value knowledge, integrity, and honesty, and conduct their lives with perseverance, tolerance, wisdom, and insight. Sufficiency, it points out, and is at pains to point out, is not self-sufficiency, as I've said, nor is it any kind of turning inward or rejection of the global economy. Nor is it a turning back to an older and simpler way of life. It's intended to be entirely forward-looking, to enable people and their economies to remain self-reliant and independent while participating fully in the global economy. It's intended to be consistent with the Buddhist middle way, although again, the report is at pains to point out that it is not a religious movement and it does not depend upon being a Buddhist, and indeed that it's energetically supported by a very substantial Muslim population in Thailand, and also, it says, by a Catholic priest. I don't know why it's just one Catholic priest in all this, but anyway, that was the best they can do. And it's attracting some attention. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan in 2006 described the sufficiency economy philosophy as of great relevance to communities everywhere through these times of rapid globalization. The philosophy's middle way approach, he says, strongly reinforces the United Nations' own advocacy of a people-centered and sustainable path towards human development. Now, behind the development of this thinking were the less satisfactory effects of rapid economic development in Thailand. In 1985, manufacturing exports had overtaken agricultural exports, and by the early 1990s, a new Japanese factory was opening in Thailand every 3 days. Around 1 million people were moving from agriculture into the industrial economy every year. GDP growth was spectacular, averaging 7.6% per annum for many years, and per capita income between 1957 and 1997 multiplied no less than 7 times. So the economy was growing, and growing very rapidly. But many of the side effects of that sort of growth were apparent, particularly ever-growing inequality in the distribution of the wealth that was being produced. It was accompanied by significant environmental decline. Thailand lost 2/3 of its forest cover. There was social disruption, and there was individual loss of control, all of these taking their toll, particularly on the majority rural populations. It's interesting that the report notes that the inequality arose when people found that they were denied access to land, to water, and to forest resources that were fundamental to their livelihood. And looking into this, I discovered that the World Bank had in fact promoted a very active land titling program during the period of rapid economic growth. The idea of a land titling program is to establish titles to land so that land can be bought and sold. They were quite successful in this. This has been a significant policy of the World Bank for quite some time now. And part of its benefit is that it makes it possible to use the land as security for loans. And in using the land for security of loans, it is possible to build up a financial system which can provide cash capital for industry, agriculture, and any other economic activity. That at least is the idea. Now, as we now know, using land as security for loans can have its problems. And in Thailand, it did have its problems, and there was a very serious economic collapse in 1997. Now, with the disappearance of the forests, the new industrial economy and the new and rapidly growing urban centres brought about huge demands for water and began to create water shortages. Old customs of shared labour and other forms of local exchange disappeared with the intensification of market agriculture. As a result of that, people became more and more involved in production systems over which they had no control. Rural debt escalated relentlessly, and a feeling of helplessness began to dominate rural life. As the report puts it, villages had their own systems of insurance and defence to deal with such matters. And whether effective or not, they were the product of local wisdom. But in the new era, world prices replaced rainfall as the source of insecurity, and market forces supplanted wild animals as the predators. So what the king did was to mobilise groups of farmers, local wise men, shamans, I think, although it doesn't actually say so in the report, monks, development workers, officials, teachers, academics, and even philosophers, to address the key themes. And the key themes, as he saw them, were to rebuild a sense of community, whether it was real or imagined, in order to have greater strength to face up to global forces, to retreat somewhat towards self-reliance, in order to be able to withstand shocks, to draw attention to Buddhism, with its stress on moderation and spiritual well-being, as an antidote to the emphasis on maximizing growth and consumption, and to build horizontal networks to pool thinking and share techniques. And they began to do that. And with these intentions, they set about rebuilding the economy from the bottom up. All this while the very successful growth program was proceeding. They started by developing a model of a self-reliant family farm. They used natural cultivation methods and an appropriate mix of land use, which was thought to include having a pond for water storage and for rearing fish for food, a paddy field for rice, a field for other crops and also fruit, and a place for a house. And to bring this about, farmers were encouraged to desist from commodity farming and to reorientate around providing first for themselves and their families and then for their local communities. But this was just the first stage in the process. The report is at pains to point out that self-reliance did not mean isolation. The model farm was expected to create a surplus beyond household consumption, and this surplus could be exchanged on the local market. And the second stage was aimed at creating self-reliance at the community level by increasing the production and availability of local goods and services through mobilising the surplus resources of households within a community. This might be done through cooperative forms of production, community savings groups, community health centres, and community forms of social safety net. And then at the third stage, the community would engage with the economy beyond the village to sell its excess products and to gain new technology and resources for products, such as founding its own rice mill or tapping the services of banks and other economic institutions, and to negotiate with business corporations for mutual advantage. This is quite important because smallholders dealing with big corporations are virtually powerless. It's only when they work together that they are really able to deal on anything resembling level terms with some of the big corporations. As King Bhumibol put it, progress is not just about planting enough rice to eat. There must be enough to create schools, even works of art, so that Thailand prospers in every way, with no hunger or poverty, food for body and soul, and many other things. His guiding principles throughout were: build a base of self-reliance before moving ahead, be economical, learn continuously. And according to the report, economists in Thailand quickly grasped that embracing the sufficiency economy did not require them to abandon the theories and techniques they use as their professional tools. In terms of the economy, the sufficiency economy emphasizes the importance of shielding the country against external shocks. Just as the agricultural theory that stresses that communities need a base of strength and self-reliance to be able to deal with the world beyond the community, so a country needs a strong internal foundation to survive and prosper in a volatile worldwide economy. The sufficiency economy is not a rejection of globalization, but rather a means of succeeding in globalisation. The report outlines a number of successful applications of this efficiency economy at all levels of economic activity in Thailand, from government policy to rural farms and forests. It has applications for businesses of all sizes, for human development policies, and for national economic management. Successive governments have been persuaded to adopt the sufficiency approach because they find that it's not incompatible with more conventional economic systems. And they've been happy to encourage the growth of strength from within and to think in terms of the longer-term stability and future generations. The report, I think, inevitably paints quite a rosy picture of all this. And if you want to know more about it, the latest edition of the Economic Monitor will be on sale during the break and carries a description of it all from our chairman this evening, Dr. Bowman. Those of you who are subscribers should get your copies in the post tomorrow morning. Now, looking at this rosy picture, one was obviously enthused, and I hope I've communicated some of that enthusiasm to you this evening. Well, one had to ask, well, is there anything else going on in Thailand? Is this actually how it all works? And having been brought up in economics through the School of Economic Science, one immediately asked, well, what was happening about land and land tenure in Thailand? And as I've already indicated, what I discovered was that the World Bank had been promoting its very active land titling program, and this had caused quite significant difficulties. It was extremely controversial. Rural people in many parts of Thailand found that land which they had been using traditionally for centuries had suddenly been sold and fences were appearing in their fields. Forest land, which wasn't titled, was taken into state ownership. And suddenly, people whose families had lived in the forest, and much of Thailand was forest, people who successfully lived in the forest for generations, found that they no longer had any rights to the economic basis of their lives. It's now estimated that there are some 500,000 families who are landless as a result of all this, families who previously would have felt that they had an establishment and an interest in the country where they lived. And it just highlights the fact that the sufficiency economy, however idealistic and optimistic it may be, comes up, as does every other economy, against the same problem that faces every other attempt at reform in economics. Land reform in Thailand is and has been as controversial as anywhere else. During the boom years, when there was a lot of money being generated, a lot of wealth being generated, land became an obvious place to invest it. And that's a story that is as old as history itself. And if you can establish private ownership of land, then inevitably you create land scarcities. The result of that, of course, is that land prices rise. The conventional view of which is that that is a good thing because it means that you can borrow more on the basis of more valuable land. And while one can see the logic of that, the events of the last 2 or 3 years have also indicated that it is not a very firm foundation for a strong, stable, and long-term sustainable financial system. In 1997, it's interesting that when the Asian economic collapse hit Thailand, it hit very hard. Millions of people were thrown out of work. But one does come across reports which suggest that this was not nearly so severe as it might have been, because the rural economy was strong enough to take up quite a lot of people who'd been thrown out of work in the towns. And there one sees the virtue in King Bhumibol's building up of the rural economy. It's also interesting to note that in the distant past, by which I think I mean about 100 years ago, the established system was that land holdings could only go up to a certain size, and the size of a permissible land holding was determined by the amount of land that it took to support a family. It's interesting to note that a similar system existed in Anglo-Saxon England before the land was effectively privatised by William the Conqueror. That system was abolished and the economics developed around that. Now, it is possible to deal with that. It's possible to deal with it while having due respect for the established system that exists in our Western culture now and in other cultures around the world. and different places will have their own ways of addressing these problems. In the school, we've traditionally looked at addressing it through the tax system, to restoring some of the inequities of private land ownership by pointing out very simply that mere ownership confers benefits which are conferred by the community as a whole and not by any efforts of the owner of a particular piece of land, and that there should be an obligation, at least where productive land is concerned, to repay that to the community itself. Increasingly now, we also look at the financial arrangements and ask seriously whether stable financial systems can be built on a system of borrowing on land security, and whether, in fact, a more practical system of credit and a more stable system of credit could not be devised, which was based rather upon the simple fact that proper investment produces wealth which can itself be used to repay the investment, and that somehow the whole approach to providing credit for economic activity has to be revised so that it's related to wealth production, not to being able to sequester pieces of land whose prices will go up, but in the inevitable course of things will come down again. Now, what is all this to do with a world without want? I hope it shows that where there's some determination and political will, it is possible to build on the sort of values expressed by Dr. Schumacher all those 40-odd years ago, and by others at other times. I hope it shows that there are alternatives to rebuilding the flawed edifice of modern economics with its flawed foundations. The idea of sufficiency, sufficiency of living conditions, sufficiency of consumption, both of food and material goods, and even sufficiency of profit, rather than maximisation of profit, is in fact entirely consistent with ideals of justice and equity for everyone. And the experience of Thailand shows that they can be successfully applied to produce a sort of middle way, which I hope would be a significant improvement on the so-called third way. A middle way between the sort of heedless progress of recent years and apparent helplessness in the face of it. In the school, we hold to the view that justice and equity can and should shine through economic life. It may not happen soon, but we insist that it is possible. And part of our work is to continue to hold out that possibility. And I hope that the ground covered in this lecture has pointed to some of the real needs and possibilities of the present time, and at least some of the ways in which they could be addressed. And I think it's appropriate to finish by noting that economics with justice is offered alongside practical philosophy. The example of Thailand shows that philosophy can also be practical economics. And it's the two together, economics with philosophy, that do offer a new direction to a troubled world. And I hope that it's been possible to show you that that direction is a possibility which could be realised. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your attention. We'll have some refreshments now. You certainly deserve it. And if there's anyone left, there'll be time for questions afterwards. Thank you very much.